Allen's Investigate, airing live on the United Public Radio Network, 105.3 FM in New Orleans. And welcome to the Allen's Investigate with me, Shona Allen.
And I'm Gary Allen, the Cockney Bard.
We're broadcasting live on the United Public Radio Network 105.3 and 107.7 FM from New Orleans and also on Roku. This week, we'd like to welcome our very special guest, Andrew Goff, writer and presenter of historical mysteries, editor of the Heretic magazine and TV personality. It's estimated that Andrew's television work is viewed by over 2 million people globally each week. His appearances include Ancient Aliens, Mysteries of the Ancient Dead, Forbidden History, NASA's Mysteries, and lots of others. Andrew has published and written for publications of all kinds as an active presenter on the conference circuit. He's also renowned for his research on the sacred bee, and most recently he's uncovered compelling new research into the legends of a hollow earth. In support of this, he has co-founded Project Restoration, where technology can locate chambers deep beneath the earth. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here with you guys.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. Thank you.
Thanks, lovely to see you, and thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a real pleasure.
Well, hey, Andrew, I thought we could maybe start off by talking to you and asking you what drew you towards these subjects of the esoteric.
Well, I think that once you just sort of dip your toe in these subjects, you quickly dive in head first. And, you know, I've lived in the UK since 97. And before I moved to England, I traveled to Egypt and South America and all over the place like you do. But I remember driving to a dinner party on this small English road, and there's no sat nav then. And I got lost, and all of a sudden I look up, and there is this, what I instantly recognize as a pyramid, Silbury Hill. And I was just like, "What? Hang on, what is this?" And I became really obsessed with sort of all things megalithic, and that leads to, you know, a thousand different things. So, I think once you find one area of interest, that the whole world opens up in the world of esoteria.
Definitely. And so moving on from that, what got you into writing and TV work?
Well, it's a really interesting story, because I became kind of obsessed with the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau, you know, south of Carcassonne, yeah. Holy Blood, Holy Grail. Mm-hmm. 1891, a priest discovers something in his church, and all of a sudden he appears to be a wealthy millionaire, and he decorates his church in all this esoteric fashion. And so I got really into that. And my friend Simon Cox said, you know what, I'm going to write a book about what really is the truth behind the Dan Brown Da Vinci Code. Do you want to help me with it? So I ghost wrote the first half of it, which is about how the mystery of Rennes Le Chateau, you know, Berenger Saunier, right? Saunier is the character who's laid out in the form of a pentagram in the opening scenes of the movie in the book. That's an ode to Berenger Saunier. So Dan Brown knew all about that story, and hence the lawsuit between Michael Bajan and himself later on. But I said, sure, I'll do it. So I wrote it, and I wrote myself into the story just to watch Simon as the guy who solves the mystery, and it has to do with the number 22. And I knew they would take it out, but the publisher said, that's brilliant. No, we're keeping it, but you're nobody. You need a website. So I created a website, and you know, what am I going to write about? So I wrote a small blog about how King Arthur could have been an archetype, not a real historical person. Just very little mention of him and the 12 knights and the 12 constellations, all that sort of stuff. And National Geographic calls up and says, oh, we liked your blog. Would you like to be in The Truth Behind King Arthur? We want to fly you over Tintagel and explore some ancient relics that are attributed to Arthur. I'm like, Are you kidding me? Yeah, I'd love to. And then it just takes off from there.
Mm. Yeah, so it's a very interesting thing, isn't it? The Venus Shadow mystery.
So it's quite a synchronistic kind of series of events, basically, that got you into it, really.
Yeah, and you know, my passion for Rennes Le Château, I became chairman of the society that studies it. I busted and am acknowledged as having busted Ben Hammett's hoax, where he found the a chap who allegedly found that the tomb of Mary Magdalene buried in the cave outside of Rennes Le Château. And he had the artifacts from the wedding of Mary and Jesus. And made documentaries, movies, and I got really close to his ex-wife. I got close to him, found out that he had made videos of himself finding a Loch Ness monster previously. And make a long story short,
as you do, yeah.
He had hired the Academy Award-winning special effects chap from RoboCop and Alien to create a miniature tomb in his back garden, and. Anyway, I forced a confession, and he said, he was pleased that I forced a confession because probably saved him from going to jail, because he had just reconstructed the Ark of the Covenant and put it in a cave in the south of France, and he was selling it to the Israelis, and if they found out that was a hoax,
It's quite interesting because somebody that we met sent us a picture of what was supposed to be the Ark of the Covenant in a cave in France.
That was in a cave, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yeah. So maybe the same one, I don't know.
you mentioned that the synergy, though. So because I got really into all aspects of the story. And when Patrice Chaplin came out with City of Secrets, and the real mystery of Rennes Le Château is not in France, it's in Girona. I went to Girona and I wanted to get to know this Kabbalist who one of the key people in her book. And I meet the Kabbalist, and this Kabbalist has mentored Salvador Dali and John Cocteau, the last alleged grandmaster of the Prior of Zion. She asked me to study with her, and I went there to study the parchments from the Rennes Le Château storyline. And as we're having breakfast on her balcony, bees start flying around. And so we got to talking about bees. And for 3 years, I studied, I say study, she's no longer with us, sadly, but she would lecture 15 hours a day. You're not allowed bathroom breaks or questions. It's just a fire hose. on the esoteric history of bees. So I went off on this big bee tangent, which also got me into a lot of the goddess stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
It because, is. It's very important.
Yeah, the Rennes Le Château thing, we're very interested in that. And I understand you also interviewed Henry Lincoln in, when was that, 2006, was it?
Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of all those guys. And, you know, Henry Lincoln's catchphrase, don't believe a word of it. I really, as much as I love like the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, and I've read every Henry Lincoln novel. They all pretty much have said they made it up. In fact, I think Henry was complicit with Plantard and said in the whole creation of the myth, I don't buy into the Brari of Zion. And, you know, there's enough real mysteries out there. I find it as exciting to bust something as a hoax as I do reveal something as a mystery that people didn't think was a mystery.
For sure.
Well, that's the point of it. We're only interested in the truth. So
it's interesting as well because I found some time ago that this one of the things that they kind of try and attribute to the mystery of Rennes Le Château is this terribilis des locustis over the doorway of the church.
This place is terrible.
This place is terrible. Actually, it doesn't mean that. It means that this place is a place of awe. And it's not unique to the church because all Roman Catholic churches actually do that. And it comes from Genesis 28:17. And it says, he was afraid and said, how awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God. This is the gate of heaven. So it's quite a common dedication on a Roman Catholic church.
Well, Asmodeus is interesting as well, isn't it? You know, I mean, Asmodeus, you know, they say it's the devil and all that, but that came from a church originally. So I don't know if you know that part of the story, but that came from a church. And so, and it ends up in Rennes-le-Château. And if you do an anagram of the name Asmodeus, it's Soma Dias, you know, mind of God. So it's interesting.
Well, it's also interesting that he is the guardian of Solomon's treasure.
Exactly.
So how could Solomon's treasure possibly be in that vicinity? Well, when Rome sacked Jerusalem, then the Visigoths sacked Rome. The Visigoths came here, and you know, Toulouse, their home, is not too far away. And of course, the legend is Rhea is Rennes-le-Château. And the thing that I find really interesting is I got to be really good friends with Jean-Luc Robin, who lived in Saunier's home and maintained it. And this guy was so level-headed. He was murdered because he helped oust the bad mayor in Rennes-le-Château. The day of the election, but his work on the subject is just so straight and so good. But he recounted the story when the oldest person in the village died, and his friend is telling him this, and his friend was at the funeral, and he was talking to the next oldest person in the village who was still alive, and they were talking about Maria Denerud, who was Saunier's Madonna, his helper. And they were saying that he remembered going to school and having Maria teach Sunday school. And at the end of every Sunday school session, she would close the book and say, "Oh, children, if I could only tell you the real story." So it's kind of, you know, I think where there's smoke, there's fire. And I know you guys are really big into the Knights Templar. And I'd be curious to get your thoughts. My research and that of Klaus Dana, who is my partner in crime and a lot of initiatives, is that the Motherlode from Jerusalem, in terms of relics, you know, we have the Knights Templar going all over the world, from Russia to India to South America, and bringing back the most incredible pieces of literature and artifacts, etc. The Motherlode moved near Rennes-le-Château, I hate to say it, and then up to Le Havre, the north of northwest of France, two boats to Nova Scotia, three boats to England. And whether that those details are correct or not, nobody knows for sure. But you know, it's the 13th century, it's the 14th century. Times are hard. You have the most valuable artifacts in history.
Well, I think the thing is with Solomon's Temple as well is that, I mean, I'm probably going to be a bit controversial here, but Solomon's Temple, did it really exist or was it an allegory of something?
Well, yeah, and even Solomon, but if, I mean, just to finish that thought, the Knights Templar, I mean, there were no safety deposit boxes or they buried this stuff. Why would you bury it when you could live a good life, get some slaves? I know that's not very politically correct, but back in the day, and just have a life of luxury and ease. No, you bury it. Did you bury it because you thought the baddies were after you and you would reclaim it and do something with it? Or were you trying to prevent them from destroying the legacy that you were trying to preserve by hiding it, by burying it?
Exactly.
And maybe it's the burying of you know, secrets and knowledge as well, you know, not just physical treasure but actual knowledge, wisdom that they gleaned while they're over in the Middle East?
Yeah, there's schools of thought and different sources would have you believe that maybe the Library of Alexandria didn't burn, or maybe it did, but the books didn't burn with it. Mm-hmm. There's traditions of that being preserved. And that information, you know, we're just coming out of Build Back Better and the Great Reset. And we could dive into Tartaria and all that sort of thing. I think there's been many great resets and many lost eras of knowledge. I am personally looking to try to collect encyclopedias before the First World War, because they have incredible things in them that have been airbrushed in history that you can't find today. Maps and don't get me started on Antarctica.
No. The Piri Reis map is quite an interesting one, isn't it?
Yeah, I was just, I have a home in Istanbul, and I was just there in, about 3 or 4 months ago, and I went to a Topkapi Palace, one of my favorite places. That's where it's kept. I'm like, please, can I see it? I've asked, you know, been asking for a decade now. No, it's under lock and key. Why is it under lock and key? Why would you not have that as your premier exhibit?
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Does beg the question, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, what does it reveal? And Topkapi Palace, you know, I've written about, speaking of Solomon, and I'm with you on that, because Solomon is a really, what's the right word? Not shady, but it's just not very clear who he was, if he was.
Exactly. There's not really a great deal of actual physical evidence to say that he ever existed, actually, is there, apart from, of course, in the Bible?
Yeah. So it's difficult to say. And forgive me, what were we just talking about a moment ago?
We were just talking about the Piri Reis map.
Yes.
Turkey.
You have the Privy Chamber, which has, have you guys been there?
No, I've been to Turkey, but I've not been there. No, unfortunately, I must go and visit.
You know, this is Constantinople, right? So they've got the arm of John, the turban of Joseph, the staff of Moses, and you can't take any photos. You walk around. It has the shroud from the Black Stone in Mecca. Has all these incredible things. And you walk around, and it's like a normal museum. But there's one room that's so holy. There's a chap in there who reads from the Quran 24 hours a day, and multiple guards carrying semi-automatic machine guns. And I'm like, okay, what's in that room? And then you have this big box that has the coat of Muhammad's friend. I'm like, well, why is that more special? Coat of Muhammad, not Muhammad, his friend. Mm. Oh, hang on. It's not the coat, it's the box. It's a big gold chest. And so I looked into it, and the last place that the Ark of the Covenant was seen was Constantinople, because the Vandals, the Visigoths sacked Rome for a couple of days. The Vandals sacked it for a couple of weeks, and Rome knew what they lost, so they chased him back to North Africa. And then, make a long story short, that stuff is rescued by Constantinople, and they have the Ark of the Covenant, and they're about to reopen the Hagia Sophia. And what does Justinian say? Solomon, I have eclipsed thee. Well, you've got the Ark of the Covenant, and you now have the greatest temple on the planet. So it's interesting that a lot of these things are hidden in plain view.
Yeah, hidden in plain sight. Yeah, there's no question about that. But, you know, it's the thing is, like, with the Bible and other books like that, the problem is you've got, you know, like 750 contradictions. So, you know, when you're talking about truth and you're searching for truth, you have to pick through it, because like Ben Johnson, I think he said that the Bible was a book of allegories, and so that's how we view the Bible, in allegory. and try to ascertain, you know, what they were really trying to say.
And all the books that were taken out of it. I mean, I don't trust, and I've never really been like this. I mean, it's a gradual thing. You asked how I got into it. And, you know, we hear this overused phrase of the Great Awakening, supposed to be the Great Reset, but it turned into the Great Awakening. And now I just don't trust any single thing that a history book says, because his story is exactly that.
Well, it's history. History is written by the victors. It's very, very true. Oh, actually,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. All the books are, you know, I mean, what do you believe? You know, I mean, we're really interested in the Templars and the Rinnishadow mystery and everything else. But when you pick through the bones of everything and you think, well, that's absolutely ridiculous. And so then you look through other things and you think, I mean, it wasn't so long back. I went to Montsegur and was up on the top there and tried to take some pictures, and not one of 20 pictures came out, which is which is rather interesting. And there is something special about the place, but it's not what we're told it is. I mean, no way.
I don't think so.
It's a ridiculous story. And, you know, Gerard de Seed and others have just...
I think it was Gerard de Seed, actually, in his book Lord de Rennes in 1967, it was he that coined the phrase Asmodeus, because it wasn't called that before he called it that. It was just called the devil. And it's, again, it's something that you see relatively commonly in a Catholic church. But what is interesting, Andrew, I was just going on to talk to you about that, was I've been looking at the Green Men. I mean, it's a fairly modern description. They were foliate heads, but for modern interpretation, Green Men. Yeah. And what I did find, which I thought was quite interesting and maybe something to think about, was that quite often as well, you'll see the Green Men stooped. And there's one very famous one in Exeter Cathedral, and the Virgin Mary is actually standing on top of a stooped green man. And sometimes these subservient positions of these green men, they can also be dragons as well. Mm. So I thought that that's quite something interesting to think about.
Yeah. I mean, the original King Arthur, green, devil, green... Osiris, green, and you have the green children of Wolput outside of Bury St. Edmunds. And
the mean green dress.
green dress is China, right?
A fantastic subject for St. Patrick's Day. But, you know, the green children of Wolput had William of Newburgh, the blogger of the day, in real time interviewing these kids. Boy and girl, brother and sister. The boy dies of malnutrition. Their skin is green. Their clothes are weird. They can't speak any language anyone's ever heard of. Eventually, the girl is taught English, and she learns to tell the tale of having come from St. Martin's Land down below and having heard the bells of Bury St. Edmunds and found their way in the surface, et cetera, et cetera. The inner earth thing is fascinating. And one of my big adjuncts on that is asking the question, are we also living in a layer of the inner earth? And given the firmament, this snow globe structure that every ancient culture has spoken about, it's really really interesting to explore that. And I think
it's interesting with, because I think I spoke to you about that before briefly, that Wernher von Braun, who worked at NASA, is under Operation Paperclip. We had a number of scientists from Germany come over to here and to America in particular. And Wernher von Braun, he worked at Disney. That was one of the things he did. But also... He also worked on, you know, rockets and things like that as well. And it's really interesting. But that what I was going on to say is that on his tombstone, I believe there is a reference to, I think it's John in the Bible, which talks about the firmament.
Psalm 19, and the glory of God is the firmament. And you know, They've released a couple years ago, they declassified some documents from the Cold War, and they're like this thick full of boring documents about Russian documents from the Cold War. But within there, in 1958 and 59, the Russians are photographing the firmament, taking its temperature and analyzing it. And 1959 is the same year that the Antarctica Treaty was created for Antarctica. You know, two countries can't agree on anything, let alone 22 countries agreeing on everything. Stay the hell away from Antarctica. Don't even think of going there. Well, not only is it the entrance to one of the entrances to the inner Earth, but you have access to the ice wall. It's just Obama in 2010 said that the goal of NASA, he wanted to rejuvenate NASA, who from 1968 to 72 went to the moon four times allegedly, but we've lost all the footage and the technology.
And the technology, yeah.
Well, yeah.
funny that.
And the moon is 238,000 miles away, and Obama says the goal, we have to get past low Earth orbit, which NASA says is 100,000 miles. So how did you get to the moon if you can't get past low
Earth? Well, I don't know how to get past Van Allen's belt, buddy.
Van Allen was guilty, Operation Fishbowl. He was, you know, sending up rockets, balloons with rockets flying off and nuclear bombs. Why would you set off nuclear bombs at the top of the horizon, atmosphere, if you weren't trying to break through it? Yeah. And movies like Truman Show, they're kind of laughing at us. They know the reality of this. Truman, his whole life is in this bubble. But at the end, when the director, Ed Harris, is sitting and looking at his table, there's like the globe of the Earth with this dome going over. I mean, the whole thing, you couldn't make it up. And then in 2014, in 2014, the civilian aviation, bunch of non-NASA enthusiasts sent a rocket up with cameras, and it's 70 miles above the Earth's surface. It doesn't explode. It sticks. It sticks something.
Yeah.
And eventually falls down. That's the firmament, the watery abyss that separates Earth from the watery abyss beyond.
Which is interesting because this sort of takes us to ancient Egypt, because they had Geb and Nut, didn't they? Initially in their sort of creation myth, they were stuck together in sort of, how shall we put it?
Relations.
And... it's a before 9 o'clock show. Anyway, they're having relations and they actually have to be taken apart, don't they? So Nut then becomes the firmament, the sky, and Geb is...
Exactly. Nut is the firmament. There's just so much evidence. It's not even true. And there's very early documents that place Stanley Kubrick with Arthur C. Clarke and the two of them. It was really Arthur C. Clarke who is the brains behind the famous film of Kubrick, and who loved the famous film of Kubrick was NASA. I mean, it's now almost acknowledged that Kubrick did the so-called NASA moon missions. I mean, it's Bill Nye.
He gave some clues, didn't he, in his films?
Oh, lots of clues. And yeah, I was going to say, Bill Nye, who's got multiple PhDs, he's the science guy. He's a TV show in the National Science Foundation, funded by the National Science Foundation in the U.S. And Bill Nye has publicly said, the Earth is a closed system. There is no place to go. You cannot leave.
It's absolutely... Funny thing is, I've been really into this for quite a long time. And, it puzzles me greatly, but I'd like to know the truth. And I never believed that they went to the moon. I never, ever believed that. And, it's always a question about, is the Earth flat or I don't know the answer to that, but I certainly don't think they've ever been outside the outside the earth. I don't. So, you know, it raises a lot of questions, doesn't it?
You know, I presented at the Awakening Conference last summer, really big conference, live streamed to 2 million people on Gaia. And Giorgio was there. You know, I'm a big fan. Eric Von Daniken, big fan. Giorgio got up on stage and said, you know, there's maybe 1,000 people in the audience. How many of you, first of all, he said, you know, a really trendy topic right now is the flat earth. And I looked at their website and it said the flat earth, acknowledged by people all over the globe.
Yeah, I saw that.
And then he said, everyone who believes in the flat earth, raise your hand. And I would say at least a third of the audience raised their hand. And he said, okay, there's the effing door. You can leave now.
Oh.
So when censorship is all about something, you better believe it's closer to the truth than anything else.
Mm.
So we are to believe that we're spinning at 1,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
While traveling 666,000 miles an hour around the sun.
660. Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, dear.
And since like the 50s, late 50s, early 60s on the planes, all the windows are bubbled. Is that not the word bubbled? That's not bubbled. They're bowed.
Mm-hmm. Oh, dear.
Yeah. So you can see what appears to be a curvature. So I don't believe it's a flat earth. I think it's it's a more dimensional conversation than flat versus
I think that you basically you can say that it's not perhaps quite as we've been taught.
Yeah, when I say Norfolk's flat.
Yeah, well, we live in Norfolk. Well, people are saying we're flat.
Yeah, it's a flat earth in Norfolk. Don't worry about that.
Oh, give anyone, is that a bicycle?
Oh, my God. I think they talk about the Akel Strait and the Tiyama. That's about it, really. That's about straight.
So you I understand you guys have some connections to the whole John Dee story up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's quite interesting because Dr. John Dee actually did visit Norfolk, specifically Norwich, a couple of times, and also Queen Elizabeth I visited Norwich on one occasion as well. Francis Bacon. There's also a connection to Francis Bacon, who is one of the supposed contributors or masterminds behind the Shakespeare works. There's another controversy there. Yeah. His family actually did have places in Norfolk, and one of them, which I found out fairly recently, was actually Stiffkey Hall. Mm. And Francis Bacon's father, Nicholas Bacon, keeper of the Great Seal, actually built Stiffkey Hall. So it's quite amazing.
Yeah.
But Arthur Dee, which is John Dee's son, Arthur Dee was actually, he named him after King Arthur, interestingly.
Wow.
Yeah.
He had a sunny disposition, didn't he?
That's right, a sunny disposition. That's
yeah,
right.
He did, exactly. Yeah.
And actually, just as an aside, if you go on to Monty Python and the Holy Grail, Graham Chapman, who plays King Arthur, if you notice on his tabard, he actually does have the sun on it.
Yeah.
So they're giving you a little clue there.
Sorry. I don't know.
Round table. Astrological zodiac, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe.
Anyway, I digress.
But yes,
Arthur Dee actually did retire, in inverted commas, to Norwich, and he actually lived next door to Sir Thomas Browne, who was the polymath and philosopher and physician, who was actually a great admirer of Francis Bacon's work and the Baconian method. So Arthur Dee basically was also very much into alchemy and studied very much the same subjects as his father. And he passed on some of his father's manuscripts onto Sir Thomas Browne. And also when he passed away, he bequeathed his alchemical papers to Sir Thomas Browne.
Where there's a statue of Thomas Browne
in Norwich.
In Norwich, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating.
Wow.
But there's also something else interesting, Andrew, is that Sir Francis Bacon, if in a, you know, he left two wills, apparently. The first will said he would be buried obscurely. And in St. Gregory's Church, there's a wall plaque that's written in Latin, which is fantastic. And it's all about Sir Francis Bacon. And there's a tomb, which is for another Sir Francis Bacon, and that's a judge. So it's my, yeah, we think that Francis Bacon is not buried in St. Albans. We actually believe it's St. Gregory's. We can't prove that, but the plaque on the wall is very, very significant.
And it definitely mentions, you know, the Viscount of St. Albans, both in name and in blood.
Yeah.
Which I think is fascinating.
That's so interesting. It really
is. Norwich is a wonderful place. And if you ever get the chance, Andrew, please come along, because there's so much to look at. And what about that painting of Sir Francis Bacon, The Unknown Man?
Oh, yes, at Oxborough Hall. That's very interesting as well. It's a beautiful moated house. There are portraits of Queen Elizabeth I, but also there's a couple of portraits of Sir Francis Bacon, one of which it says Sir Francis Bacon, the unknown man, on the portrait.
Wow. It is amazing, yeah.
So it's quite exciting, I think.
It's really
bearing
exciting,
bearing in mind his links with Norfolk, I think it's exciting. And also going on about this same church, it actually has this wonderful wall mural of St. George and the Dragon, which I think is rather interesting. Norwich's patron saint was St. George, and we had the Guild of St. George in Norwich as well, hence this connection with dragons. We have a lot of connection with dragons in Norwich. So it's very, very interesting. But Arthur Dee is buried in the Church of St. George, which is interesting. But unfortunately, we did try to find out whereabouts in the church, and they don't know. So, sadly.
You know, I think Norwich is a really unsung place of significance. The cathedral's amazing, the best roof bosses I've ever seen. But Julian, the anchoress, is an anchoress, you know, woman, 12th, 13th century, mostly UK, France, who would dedicate her life from the age of 12 to God. And they would build a cell around her, usually with a small window that looked upon the high altar in the church. And she would never leave for the rest of her life. The Anchoress of Shear was a really good novel about an anchoress, historical fiction. But anchoresses were also really connected to Knights Templar. And one a site in the UK where I'm excavating, that it's a Knights Templar site, known historical Knights Templar town on the Meridian. And I shouldn't really go where I was about to go. It has something to do with
No.
Don't worry.
Had a good inkling where this site was, and used a variety of techniques to validate it. The best GPRS in the world, the dowser who was employed by Exxon. But during lockdown, I stumbled upon an ex-Iraqi IT guy who had access, a console who had access to Elon Musk's SpaceX satellites. He wanted $15,000. I'm like, no, that's too rich for me. And during lockdown, I said, I'll give you $500 today, or you can have 1% of what we find. He said, just give me the £500. and he came away, went away. I did hear from him again. I'm like, oh, God, you're so gullible. He came back 2 weeks later and said, I do this for a living, and never in my life have I seen anything like it. There's chambers and tunnels and the heat, the satellite images. Can I please have the 1%? But my point in bringing that up is He said, I have access to the world's most powerful underground satellites. And when I point them at what I know is like an ancient place, whether it's Machu Picchu or wherever. And this is like a really tough 30-year-old, just real raw kind of personality. He said, all the servers burn and things just start literally blowing up. And it's as though the site's protected.
Interesting.
And yeah, I think there's something to that, actually.
Do you think also that it might be to do with some sort of geomagnetic forces or ley lines perhaps as well, or something like that?
Could do. And yeah, so the Anchoress is part of that story, interestingly enough. So I've done some research into Julian, who's the most famous Anchoress in the UK, I think, in Norwich. But going back to Dee, and you know, I go to Mortlake frequently, and you know, I lived in Richmond for 12 years, and I'm not too far away from that now. Mm. So Mortlake is where John Dee had his house and the greatest library in the history of India. And you know, there's two paths. The Queen Elizabeth would come up by boat on the Thames, which is where his library was, his property, or she would come by horseback, and that path is still there today. And he's buried under the high altar. They can't find it because they've changed the church since that time. But the custodian of the church has allowed me after hours, and I must take him up on this and stop stalling, to go douse for where Dee is buried.
Interesting.
And the thing about that, it's such valuable property. I mean, the whole area is really affluent. Shamefully, they've torn down his house. They've torn down the old laboratory. When he got back from, you know, Czech Republic, and when he got back from Europe, all those books and all the greatest alchemy lab and the greatest library, probably on the planet, was pillaged. But nothing is there, but just a grass plot. So all around it, it's built up, except for where the world's greatest alchemy lab and library used to be. It's as though it won't let anything get developed there.
Because there's no, it's not in the registry there, is he, or the graveyard. They don't know where he's buried there, do they? But they know he's there, I think.
If you go to Wikipedia, it says that they don't know where he's buried, but locally, everyone believes it's under the high altar of the church. Yeah. And there's a plaque there now, plaque in the church at last, and a plaque on the Thames saying this is where, you know, John Dee's house used to be. And tomorrow, I'm taking a Turkish friend of mine who hasn't been to the British Museum, and I always go.
Fantastic, yeah.
Crystal ball, Skyrian mirror. I mean,
the obsidian,
Nation objects. They probably changed the course of history, right?
Absolutely. Did you see the Monos Hieroglyphica from 1564 is an interesting where no vulgar eye is going to find what's in it. But anyway, and also the notes from John Dee's private diaries are interesting, which gives a real insight into his, you know, his private life. And it's fascinating, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. And they have obscure things like, he was apparently obsessed with the London Stone and moved near it because he thought it was really magical. The stone that if anything happened to the London Stone, you know, London would perish. You know, Shakespeare wrote about it. Blake wrote about it. And Dee was quite obsessed with it. So,
Well, that's right. But, you know, the thing is, I'm very interested in the channeling, because it's coming to my life. But you know, with John Dee, the funny story is when he met Edward Kelly, I think it was 1587, and Kelly was doing some scrying, and he told Dee that the spirits wanted to swap wives, you know, which as you do. But I think that Jane was better looking than the other one, than Kelly's wife. And it's sort of, anyway, apparently from my notes that I took on it is that D told Jane, his wife, that it was God's will that man share everything. What do you reckon about that then?
Well, and D was in his early 50s and his wife was in her early 20s at the time. Whoa. So, you know, I don't think Kelly was
oh, Kelly wasn't stupid, was oh my gosh.
He was a very naughty boy.
He was a very naughty boy.
She gets pregnant, right? She gets pregnant.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think that I was saying that that the child that was born, because shortly after that, I think it was a year later, D.N. Kelly's communications with angels ended, which is interesting. That was in 1589. So, yeah, it is fascinating. And what's also interesting is that Dee died in 1609, which is the year of the sonnets. I think that's interesting.
Yeah.
Because if you think about it, this is all sort of the Shakespeare thing, very interests me greatly. But Sonnet 86, where he says, "E nor that affable familiar ghost, which nightly gulls him with intelligence." And that tells you everything.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very, very interesting. And I you know, what do you think? Was D, I can't imagine D would have been gullible. They thought he was a spy for the crown.
Well, he's supposed to have taught Francis Bacon. So, you know, and the point of it is, if you look at all these characters throughout history, if you look at William Blake, Shelley, Rudyard Kipling, the guy that wrote The Soldier, Rupert Brooke, going back to Christopher Marlowe, going back to Chapman, all these people were communicating with the spirits. They all knew about this, you know. And of course, it depends what you're communicating. Like with myself, I write lots of philosophy and poetry. And it's wonderful stuff, but, you know, not from saying that from an ego point of view, but I'm saying that from the point of view that whoever gives me that inspired thought, the muses, whatever it is, I'm in awe of it. And it's wonderful stuff. So, you know, and all these people like William Blake and Shelley and Keats and all that, they were getting the same inspired stuff and the same as the musicians. And it's there for people if only they knew how to tap into it.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm a enthusiast of the tarot. And it's my opinion that when I'm doing a tarot reading or when I'm dowsing, it's not the spirit world that I'm tapping into. It's me, just like it's you. It's my future self giving me the advice and the answer I'm seeking. You know, time is now sort of not what we think it is. It's linear. It's all that. And just look at the Simpsons. Come on. You know, there's supposed to be devices. The chronometer, what a priest out of the Vatican was a whistleblower about the chronometer. They found this device in some ancient site and they brought in literally rocket scientists and other people to figure out what the hell it was. And they determined it was a device that could be programmed to look at any period in history visually. So this notion that when you're doing a tarot or you're dowsing or you're connecting with spirit, my personal feeling is that it's us from the future giving us guidance now.
Well, there was an interesting story with the tarot, and basically 78 cards in the tarot. Shona and her mum was there, and I shuffled the tarot cards out, and I picked one out, and I got the magician, card of the magician. And this happened 6 times in a row, didn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, what are the odds of that? But that's, you know, it just seemed to be drawn like a magnet to the magician card. It's fantastic, you know. And I mean, you know, with tarot cards, I mean, we've got the Rider-Waite set of tarot cards, and they're my favourite, actually.
I think they're most true to
they're quite a kind of magical them ones, aren't they?
Yeah, I'm guilty of buying more and more decks, but you always come back to the Rider-Waite. It's just visually really powerful and true, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I think all that stuff is something that we kind of disrespect today. And you have the ruler of the most prosperous nation in the world at the time wouldn't do anything without consulting it, and D. So I don't know about Kelly. I've been to Prague to his. Have you been to the White Tower in Prague?
No, I'd like to go though, because he got caught out, didn't he? Didn't go to prison, Kelly, for trying to steal the gold or something he was doing.
Yeah, this recreation of his lab, it's his actual tower where he worked, but it is like Disneyland for occultists. On steroids and acid. It has every possible definition thing magnified by 1,000. And it's just, I'm not sure if it's horrifying or hysterical to walk around, but it's got everything. And they have a number of really cool alchemy museums, real legitimate stuff there. Yeah, I've had people try to convince me that the Philosopher's Stone is the gallbladder. And
Well, if you've had it taken out, it's a problem. Oh, I don't even. But also, I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, if you've ever experienced and seen a vision of somebody, then you... But it's
interesting, but I think it takes us back again with the alchemy thing about, you know, I think that there was a physical side of it, but there was also a metaphorical, an allegorical side to it as well, an internal process, which, you know, interests me more personally.
Yeah.
So I think to me, the Philosopher's Stone wasn't necessarily an actual thing. It was more pointing towards... having gone through an actual process.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And something similar to that in a similar way kind of winds me up is the Holy Grail. And, you know, Holy Grail, it's really what's inside of you. It's your goals and ambition. No, I mean, go back to it and trace it back. And you were talking about Montségur earlier. You know, that probably Mount Sauvage from Wolfgang Eschenbach's Parsifal, he only wrote history. All of a sudden, he's writing about the Holy Grail. You had the Allens from Italy. They come into France and they become the troubadours. And they have these songs. Eschenbach hears the songs. He writes Parsifal. And there was two British Oxford historians who were banned, canceled, cancel culture. Always exists because they said that the Grail comes from an Iranian source that means pearl. But you know, by the time Mallory gets his hands on it, it's the blood of Christ or the chalice.
Oh,
that
blah blah blah,
and it's lovely and allegorical, but. I think the Grail is something, a stone from heaven. And what's a stone from heaven? It's a meteorite. And the most famous meteorite in antiquity is Kybele, which was in Turkey. Meteorites are falling on Rome. They're losing the war to Hannibal. What are we going to do? We have to go get Kybele, bring her back to Rome. They bring her back to Rome. They worship this meteorite as the greatest goddess that's ever existed. And eventually she disappears right at the same time, respectfully, that the Black Stone of Mecca appears. And the Black Stone of Mecca used to be called a Lot, which means the old woman, the keeper of destiny. And priestesses would circle it naked seven times counterclockwise. So I argue that the Holy Grail, a stone from heaven, a meteorite, could be the most venerated stone in the world and could be the Black Stone of Mecca.
Well, it's also interesting, I think, to look at going back into the ancient past. where the ancients actually did revere stones in general. And you had obviously the most significant and obvious one is the Herma stone, which basically had an erect phallus on the bottom and a head with a beard at the top. Now, a head obviously to the ancients basically depicted divinity. It was divine. Mm. So you're moving from one state to another state.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, exactly. And they were magical. The breastplate of Aaron, all these magical sort of stones. Where are they now?
Well, exactly. Because I do think I remember reading some time ago that in Mecca originally, before Muhammad came and actually decided to bring with him his one God, there were actually a number of stones there at the temple. So I think, you know, it's quite interesting, and it certainly bears looking
at. Yeah, if you really go
at,
deep in, absolutely, yeah.
Because to the ancient, I mean, the stone Zeus as well, the story of Zeus being a stone swaddled and then put in the hidden in the cave, and the stone was given to Cronos, and he then disgorged all his other children that he'd previously swallowed. I mean, within these stories, to the Greeks, it was an allegorical tale, and it's an interesting one.
Yeah, I mean, Rhea, that story is, you know, it's fascinating. And you know, Mount Ida in Crete, Mount Ida in Turkey. I've been all over that stuff. The whole sort of ancient history of bee veneration has just fascinated me from prehistory. Bees have been petrified in their own amber for 100 million years, looked as though they've been secreted in their own.
Wonderful.
Special by the ancients. And Egypt, Tabiti, the area around Cairo, land of the bee, Pharaoh's title, beekeeper, picture of a bee, Pharaoh's cartouche. And what does his headdress have? Yellow and black horizontal stripes. It's so prevalent everywhere. The most iconic monument in the United States, Washington's Monument, the big obelisk. What does it say? Mm-hmm. Lord, the honeybee.
Mm. Yeah, it's an amazing thing, isn't it? It does the figure eight.
It's interesting, I mean, it links obviously to the Masons as well. I mean, and the bee is very interesting because obviously to the ancient Egyptians, I mean, it was divine. It was the symbol of life, death, and resurrection. So it's a very, very important symbol. And I know that the Masons obviously revere the bee as well. And also, I mean, it's interesting because it links to Venus and the whole transit of Venus going through an eight-year cycle, doesn't it? So there's a number eight again, which is what the bees do with their waggle dance. They form the figure eight. So it's
and what happens if you split the eight? What happens if you split the eight?
You get 33.
You get a 33. Oh, yeah. Well, that's unimportant, isn't it?
I was in Norfolk at a festival. God, what was it? It was maybe... 7 or 8 years ago, a festival in Norfolk. I'm sure you guys have been to. I can't think of the name of it. Anyway, I'm about to come out on stage to talk about bees. They're announcing me, and I'm in sort of the off stage in the green room, getting ready to walk out. They announce me. I take a step to walk onto the stage. A bee flies down my throat.
Ooh.
Oh my God.
Oh my goodness. You were buzzed by a bee.
Buzzed.
I applied the Heilmic to myself and just kind of
good Lord.
spit up a lot of stuff. So and there's something really esoteric about the bee.
There is, most definitely, which I'm afraid that we're running out of time, and I'm really sad because we have so much more to talk to you about with that. We've got loads of stuff to cover on it. So maybe, perhaps you'll come back on for a part two at some point if you're free.
It would be my pleasure. You guys are great. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Well,
thank you so much, Andrew. It's been an absolute delight talking to you, and I hope that we can talk to you again soon.
Absolutely.
You take
care. Enjoy the rest of your St. Patrick's Day.
I'll be having the Guinness afterwards.
Take care.
Well, thank you for joining us on The Allens Investigate. You can check us out at www.theallensinvestigate.com. We're broadcasting live on the United Public Radio Network 105.3 and 107.7 FM from the beautiful city of New Orleans. And we're also going out on Roku as well, if you'd like to find us on there in all good podcasting platforms. Well, I've really enjoyed tonight. It's been so interesting.
What a fantastic guest, wasn't he?
Brilliant.
Very, very interesting man indeed.
Very interesting. And I think that we have lots more to talk about with Andrew if he'll come on. Take care.
Take care.
Bye. Bye.